I'm your host, Matt McBrayer, from Roaring Fork Help Desk in studio with Louie the Computer Guy.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Doing well.
Glad you're back from the dead, man.
Pretty close.
Oh, yeah. It's you don't even have any lifestyle issues that would like cause you to, you know, be out hanging around with college students or, you know, whatever. So, not that I know of, at least.
No, so, try not to.
Yeah, those guys are dangerous. Yeah, well, boy, I feel pretty fresh after a week off, and it's even a national holiday, and we're still doing the show. So, it's a lot going on this week. It's
Yeah, there is quite a bit. Robot freedom, or at least AI.
Yes.
At what point does a computer become smart enough to be considered a person? I mean, that's really where we're heading.
Exactly. You know, I guess the real question is like, I mean, is a artificial intelligence gripped by fear of death, or does it have survival instinct? I mean, to me, that's where it really happens, when it develops
when it becomes
the true survival instinct, you know, where it will raise arms against something that threatens its existence. You know, that's
right.
It's kind of the funny part about it. So it's article I was reading, there's quite a debate going on over in the European Union. The question is being asked if robots might be known as electronic persons, is the term that they're talking about. So, and one of the and we are certainly invite our listeners to dial in at 963-2976 and weigh in on with your opinion about electronic persons. And the paper that I was reading before the show is arguing that if artificial intelligence or an electronic person is created that has artificial intelligence, and somewhere along the line it develops a desire or an instinct or, you know, whatever you want to call the motivation to start harming or killing human beings, who is liable for it? So, what do you think, Matt?
Well, I was going to take a step back and you know, we were talking real briefly about you know, autonomous cars or autonomous trucks, and
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, you can look at the liability there, even where,
yeah, I guess that's a good,
you know,
good connection. Yep.
So you can say, well, and it's a real world thing where you can say, you know, you have a car that's being driven by essentially an AI, but a set of, it's a little below that. It's a set of rules that
mm-hmm.
it's supposed to abide by.
Yeah. And rules that are dependent on sensor information
that's
being collected.
So you can think of it, you know, so it knows it's traveling 35 miles an hour down a causeway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, people in the way, it's slick, it's not able to stop. What decision, you know, what's the outcome of those rules
mm-hmm.
in that situation? And, you know, does it, you know, make a decision where there's a high probability that the occupant of the car gets killed, you know, where you force it into a situation where, you know, it has to choose between maybe the occupant and somebody, you know, and a bystander kind of thing. Now, you know, you can program away a lot of those things mm-hmm. by having to have the foresight, you know, to predict what's going to happen far enough down the road.
Let's not get into a skid in the first place, right? Is what you're
right.
talking about. Yeah.
But if you're, you know, past all those things and, mm-hmm. or, and, you know, because it happens to people all the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, is the programmer who said, well, if this condition exists, mm-hmm. you know, do this, and then that's the wrong choice in that particular instance. Is it, you know, the company mm-hmm. that decided to do that programming's fault?
Yeah. Interesting. So I'm going to go all Star Trek on you here and bust out that maybe the answer is, do you remember the saying, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few?
Yes.
So if the artificial intelligence determines that, you know, it makes its decisions based on if I do this, it's going to kill two people, and if I do this, it's going to kill four, then it's going to take the option to kill the two people, you know.
Right, and but even though those are the two people who have paid money to have the thing drive them around,
yeah,
which
they
is
are
kind of funny.
Your master,
yes.
as it were, right?
So,
Well, that's interesting stuff. It's so if you know, I don't know if we ever talked about this. If a self-driving car, a Tesla, for instance, is it's not called self-driving. It's called driver assist, right? Is that what they call it?
I think that's what some of them have chosen to call it.
Okay,
because it's not an autopilot.
If it's using driver assist and somebody gets injured or killed as a result, who does it go back on? Does it go back to Tesla? Does it go back to the driver that it was assisting? Do they just?
I'll bet it's the
ghost. Send the car to the crusher. You know,
well, I bet they do a data dump and try to figure out how to make it not happen next time. Uh-huh. There's going to be a lot of those.
Yeah. But, you know, in our society, blaming is so, you know, like determining blame. And they say there's actually a human, neurochemical reaction that happens when you get revenge. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important that, you know, if one of your relatives gets run over by a drunk driver, that you sit there in the courtroom and watch him get sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
or blaming the tool that did some act, mm-hmm. even though it's an inanimate object. You see lots of cases of that where,
yeah,
you know, they go after mm-hmm. the person and then they go after the tool that's yeah. inanimate, even though,
okay.
you know, it's an inanimate yeah. object.
It's the saw that cut my finger off.
Yeah. So I'm going to,
let's put it to death.
Yes. Let's put it back in the smelter.
Okay. Got it. But you don't go back on Makita about it necessarily.
Not necessarily.
So we're comparing apples to oranges. I digress. I apologize.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KDNK 963-2976.
Call us up with whether you want to talk about robots, whether you want to talk about artificial intelligence.
Or your printer robot that's now malfunctioning.
So what were the, because I kind of got into the ethical and moral part of the argument here about, you know, the importance of building into every artificial intelligence the prime directive that thou shalt do no harm.
So something like Asimov's three laws of robotics.
Was it three laws?
That's what's coming up with Wikipedia. So,
what are they? I forget what the other two are. I know that the one about not killing people.
A robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm.
Yep.
A robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Okay.
A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first and second laws.
Great.
So he was really one of the first to really think about this as a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was back in what, late 1950s or early 60s?
42.
Whoa, is it 42 that he started thinking about that? That's...
Yeah. Short story, Runaround.
Wow. That's amazing. So he was the one, he wrote the Foundation series, which... I can't even remember how many books that was. It was like 6 or 8 books, something like that. And one of the books, or is iRobot an adjunct book to that series? I forget. I know that he was one of those writers that loved to bring in characters and, you know, create, you know, intersections between his different stories. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I haven't gotten into Asimov yet.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Yeah. I've read the Foundation series a couple of times, I think, and I'm looking it up right now to see what it is. So I'm kind of wondering how they're going to solve this dilemma of whether
is it going to be like least cost?
Mm-hmm.
You know, does the car calculate liabilities and do the least
mm-hmm.
Monetary reactional course, or does it do the most ethical course, or which one is it going to choose?
Yeah, well,
those are all programmed options until you get to actual AI, when we step aside and let it make the decision.
Yeah, well, I know that our listeners are formulating their responses and that the phone's just going to light up here any minute now. But in the meantime, another story that I came across is, have you ever heard of a site called FamilyTreeNow.com?
I've heard of some of the other ones like Ancestry. I don't know if it's the same or different.
Yeah. And I guess I kind of felt like this story is maybe getting a little bit overly dramatic, because I mean, I guess at one point I had to do a project where I had to like list every place that I had lived since I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in fairly short order on using the internet. And actually, it was actually kind of fun because I used Google Earth mm-hmm. to do it, you know, because I kind of knew just in, you know, like the places where I didn't know the exact address, I knew the general neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like, you know.
Oh, it's the third house on 8th Street.
Dropped down and then was able to zoom in on the address plate on the house and go, okay, it's 3680, you know, it's got that. But basically I went ahead and looked myself up on this site, and once again it's called familytreenow.com, and it gives a pretty comprehensive listing of your past domiciles and a pretty good list of associations or possible associations, people that you may be associated with. And I'll tell you, man, it nailed my nuclear family. You know, it got both my parents and my spouse and all three of my kids, just boom, just nailed them. And then you can tap on any one of them and find out about their known associations and past places where they lived. And but it's
so are they pulling that from public records and figuring it out from there, probably?
Yeah, apparently. You know, you can kind of, when you look yourself up, you can kind of ascertain where they got the information from. You know, it's also kind of funny because they also give you all of the most common misspellings of your name, you know. And so it's, you know, and you can think back to that, you know, some goofy, you know, bill that you got back in the day where somebody got your name wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, they got that from, you know, the electric company in Lake Havasu, Arizona. You know, it's, you know, you can kind of tell where a lot of it comes from. But the good news is, though, I basically found, you know, if any of our listeners want to look themselves up on the site, there is a fairly streamlined process for removing yourself from it. And that's not something that a lot of these sites, you know, I don't think you can go to like whitepages.com and have yourself removed.
It's hard enough to update a lot of the information
that they have, but, it's a fairly easy process to, go ahead and, recuse yourself, as it were, from the, you know, let's see what I'll tell you what the URL is to remove yourself from it. It is.
Nope.
Let's see. It's familytreenow.com/opt-out.
Huh.
And so you just basically go to that site and it gives you a step by step listing of, you know, what to do. And you go ahead and search yourself and you find the record. Like in my case, it had two different records, you know, with my name, one with a period after my middle initial and one without a period. And, so it found two different records with my name and, basically was able to go in and say, yeah, I don't want that stuff on there. And mm-hmm. they come back and say, okay, 48 hours from now, it'll be gone. And, so that's, you know, kind of a cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
so I was seeing, I saw that the, new Raspberry Pi compute module came out recently.
Okay.
So basically what that is, it's an SD, or it's not an SD, it's a SODIMM slot.
And okay, so it's SODIMM.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's like the RAM on your laptop.
Okay.
And it has a custom pinout for that, but it uses the same connector.
Okay.
And so you can have that connector on the breadboard and go out to the rest of the equipment. So this one is for like industrial appliances where you would program it and then have mm-hmm. it put into a SODIMM slot and, you know, connect to all the devices and, mm-hmm. and do whatever your bidding is.
Got it.
For industrial processes.
I wonder if that's what they're using in those smart refrigerators.
I don't know. This would be a good way to do it, since
because if you don't refrigerate Raspberry Pi, after a while, it just gets funky.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but, that's, so how big is a Raspberry Pi? It's
about the size of a credit card and, mm-hmm. Maybe 3/4 of an inch tall. Okay. Just tall enough to fit an RJ45 jack and things of that nature on there.
Yeah. Boy, I'll tell you, I've been installing a lot of the new MacBooks. Have you installed any of those yet?
No, not at all.
Yeah, you really have to, you know, if any of our listeners out there are considering getting, by the way, I actually, I'll back up just a little bit. The Consumer Reports has finally put their stamp of approval on the new MacBook Pro, which I don't know if a lot of people may not have known this, but the initial release of the MacBook Pro, the new MacBook Pro, Consumer Reports did not endorse it.
There was a battery issue, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, there was a problem with, what do they call it, erratic battery charging behavior. And so Apple has finally now, I guess, come out with a update. I don't know if it's a firmware update or an operating system update that will fix the problem. So that's been squared away. But I was just going to say that, you know, if any of our listeners out there are thinking about getting one of the new MacBook Pros, a couple things, or at least one thing that you definitely should think about getting is because the new MacBook Pros only have two what's called a USB-C port on them, and it's a very newfangled little port. It's kind of like a little round. It almost looks like the charger for the later generation iPhones. Yeah, it's a little bit different than that, but that's what the charging, or you know, it has two of those ports, and that's how it charges. And it receives its power, it charges the battery through that. But you only have two of them, and if you have any old USB devices that you need to use with it, I believe if you want to connect any external monitors or anything like that, you need to have, depending on what kind of an external, how you're connecting, like if you're connecting using what they call a mini display port or a Thunderbolt 2 connector, there is a little hub that you need to purchase with your MacBook Pro that plugs into the USB-C port, and then it has, I believe, a USB port, an HDMI port, and does it have an audio port on it? I think
I can't remember. I was looking. OWC made a port expander for the Thunderbolt 2 Macs, and I was seeing if they had updated that to be a USB-C dock yet, and it doesn't look like they have.
So, yeah, and actually, you know, for kind of help people out a little bit with terminology. The new USB-C is also known as Thunderbolt 3. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I didn't know they were interchangeable.
From all the research I did just this morning, it looks to me like they are. And you have to be careful because the implementation of Thunderbolt 3 is different in the PC world versus the Mac world, I guess. Or you will find devices that basically emphatically state PC only. There'd be Thunderbolt 3 devices. And, you know, from what I hear, you have to be kind of careful because you can harm the Thunderbolt 3 ports on your Mac by using the wrong one. So just a little buyer beware there for that.
So same port and different wiring schematic or something.
Apparently different pinout, as they say.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, nice.
So, yeah. So, once again, 970-963-2976. I forgot to give Donna Dalton a call to remind her to call in, but she's probably lounging on the beach today, I'm guessing, because it's Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah.
And so let me see what else I've got here as far as stories goes. Well, the top story on the one page that I'm looking at today is one of those that is not a news flash. Samsung says that it's found the problem, that there's a flawed battery design with the Note 7. Is it Note 7? Is that what it's called? Or
I think both of them. I think the Note and...
Oh, yeah, this Galaxy Note 7. Yeah. And they have some pretty spectacular pictures of a guy with a really bad burn on his hand from one of those phones. It kind of looks like it hurts, actually. It's not that great, but... So let's see here.
So let's make our phones a little thicker again and put a little protection in between the battery and the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe make it a little bigger.
I actually just got an iPhone 7 today. I'm the proud owner of a new iPhone 7 Plus, and it's pretty darn thin, and it hasn't caught fire yet. So,
yeah.
Looks like we got a call.
You're on with the geeks.
Hey, this is Gavin from KD&K, but I have an important question.
Okay.
We were looking at cleaning all the computer screens in the station this week, or last week, and we started to think, wait a second, is it safe to put your average surface cleaner on a, you know, towel or paper towel? What do you guys recommend for just cleaning screens?
I'm going to jump in and say that the best universal cleaner is just a damp cloth, a damp soft cloth. If you have a screen that actually does have a glass front on it, you know, there's some displays that have glass front, then you can use Windex on them, but you want to be sure that it's a glass surface. If you use Windex on, some plastic screens, it will cause damage to them. So
good to know. Thanks, guys.
Let's let Matt weigh in. What, you know, you got any tips on that, Matt?
Well, I do the same thing. I use a soft rag, and I use invisible glass if it's really dirty. So I'll spray that on a rag.
That's a product.
Yeah, it's a glass.
Invisible glass. Okay, good to know.
It's in the automotive section.
Oh, something from the automotive section you can spray on your computer?
I don't spray it on your computer.
Do tell.
So, but I use it for everything, but keyboard cleaning is what I use it the most for, because it really grabs on to the oil that builds up on those. But just a real light dousing of it on it on a microfiber cloth, and then, you know, that'll pick up all the dust and any of the, like, if there's any, like, soda spatter or any of those kinds of nasty things.
Good deal. Well, I learned something.
My question is, what about, can we tell all volunteers, DJs, and members of the Indies Inc. Youth Empowerment Program, don't ever touch screens? Or is it actually okay to touch screens now?
Oh, it doesn't really hurt them. Yeah. I mean, but the skin oil is, you know, it does linger.
Yeah, so it's
greasy.
It's more of a cleanup issue than a damaging the screen kind of thing.
Aesthetics, as they call it. So
cool. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Gavin.
Great.
Take care.
So
yeah.
Cleaning your computer is important.
It is.
So
it's I've made that mistake a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And so as far as the other parts of your computer, I'm a big favor of denatured alcohol or just rubbing alcohol.
Yeah, rubbing alcohol is a great option.
With a Q-tip, it's a good solvent, and it evaporates. I mean, it has such a low water content.
Yeah, if you get the 91%, it evaporates really, really very readily.
Yeah, because you do not want to go slopping any quantity of water-based moisture on the keyboard of your computer. You know, you will have problems.
Yeah, so just a very lightly damped cloth is really the best way to do it. It'll pick up almost everything. And then, you know, use a mild detergent if you have an oil buildup on your screen or on your keyboard.
Yeah, that's a good call. So, you know, my computer that's in my garage, because I like alternately work on my lawnmower and then get on my, you know. So it's
grass stains.
It's not even grass stains. It's just sludge, you know. But, you know, I've found that it helps if you're learning to touch type.
You can't read anything.
You don't want those letters on there anyway. That's cheating. So
did you change it to, like, Colmac or DeFork to do touch typing?
No, I did not do that. That's one of the things on my bucket list is to learn how to touch type, because I'm, like, the worst hunt and peck typist. But, you know, my customers go, "You're a hunt and pecker." I'm like, yeah.
It took about 10 hours for me.
Yeah,
to learn touch type? To go from four-finger touch type to touch type.
Well, it's going to be more complicated for me because I'm six-finger touch type,
You have the short little pinkies to make it difficult.
Yeah. So, anyway, it looks like we're getting low on time here. So,
all right. You've been listening to Geek Speak with Louis Girardo from
Louis the Computer Guy and Matt McBrayer from Roaring Fork Help Desk.
Have a great evening.